Grade 4 Conference, Lecture 33, Norse Mythology, Part 11. We'll take a look at the nine worlds, the nine realms that are sheltered by Yggdrasil. So down in the great depths, we have the world of Muspelheim, the world of fire. We hear very little about that. And then we have alongside it, probably slightly higher, the world of Hel, H-E-L, one L only, three-letter word, and Niflheim, the world of mists and fogs, also called the underworld. And we will hear about that. Niflheim, very important, and in the Germanic tale, that is where the Nibelung live, the very difficult and in the end very destructive dwarf race. In the Icelandic version, the world of the gnomes, of the dwarves, is called Dark Alfheim. Dark elf world, and that is above, slightly higher than the world of Niflheim, but in the same general range. And then, only then, after we pass through these three worlds, do we have then Midgard, the world of human beings. Hovering around that, in the icy mountains and fjords, impassable to most human beings, is the world of Jotunheim, the world of the great ice and frost giants, who, as we remember from a couple of lectures ago, are filled with indignation and vengefulness towards the Aesir. Even though there are times when they have intermarried, even though they have, in the end, a primal connection to the time when Ymir walked the earth, or rather was the earth. Higher than those worlds of the Midgard and Jotunheim is Alfheim, the world of the elves, Vanaheim, where the Vanir still reside, and then higher than that still is Asgard, which is the realm of the Aesir. So those are the realms of the known world of the Norse, and we might say Muspelheim is so distant that it doesn't really figure much in the story. And to counterbalance that, we have the world of Gimli, a world in which is alluded to only now and then, in which still greater beings reside, higher gods than those who manifest fully in Norse mythology, over whom the Aesir have no rule whatsoever, and whose intentions only Odin is able to dimly perceive after great sacrifice. So here is another unique aspect of Norse mythology, that there is a hierarchy implied there, that these gods, though they are great, are not the greatest. Is this something that was added by that great Christian monk, Snorri Sturluson? Is this something that was inherently in there? This is all a little bit murky, but it's very interesting, very significant, and takes us back to what I described earlier as the hierarchical relationship of these beings. The Aesir, Odin in particular, have made the sacrifice of not going on into Gimli. That world has therefore withdrawn from them. They know it's there. They know that in the end, the most important, momentous decisions about the future will come from Gimli and not from Asgard. and yet they must act as best they can under the present circumstances. The dull years in the both the opening pages and closing pages of their book have a beautiful diagram of these nine worlds and the world ash tree, which I would say is a good exercise for you as a teacher, perhaps to do on the blackboard, and certainly for the children to have as a large centerpiece in their main lesson book, or perhaps as a separate drawing. This mapping out of what is on the one hand a kind of image of the human being, which is on the other hand a kind of diagram of consciousness and of evolution. So let's look at this in another way. The world of Muspelheim, the world of fire, this is the last remnant, at least to the Norse people, of what Steiner has described as Lemuria. And I mentioned earlier how the Norns can be seen as also the final remnant of Lemurian consciousness, the pronouncers, the female figures who get everything going, but also can bring it to an end, or at least can reflect those inexorable forces of life and death. So there we have, in the depths, buried now, working in a very, very limited way, the world of fire. And of course, as many a commentator has said, in Iceland, this is no surprise, because in spite of the iciness and cold of the land, there are hot springs everywhere, and volcanoes will now and then erupt. So something of those Lemurian forces are very clear up there in the frozen north. Hel and Niflheim, very important, because this world where all is mist and all is fog is Atlantis. And this is not so fully buried, it's not so hidden to the Norse as was the world of Muspelheim, because of course you have lots of mists and lots of clouds and lots of time when the sun's light is very dim or hardly there at all. And this was the entire course of Atlantean life, that the sun never shone directly in Atlantis. It was a land completely shrouded in mist. This, to some extent, still persists in Midgard and certainly in Jotunheim. So the Atlantean quality of mist, of cloud, of darkness, of rarely, if ever, seeing the direct light of the sun, that bears an important role in these stories. And in fact, we know that there is a bridge that goes to the world of the Aesir, to Asgard. This bridge is made up of a rainbow. Now, when do you see a rainbow? You see a rainbow when there is a lot of moisture in the sky, usually after a rain, or where there is a particular configuration of mists and clouds, as in Hawaii or other semi-tropical lands, and where the sun is shining into that mist, reflecting then, being refracted from the droplets in the air. So a particular combination of air and moisture and light gives us the rainbow. So we could say that the sun only shines enough in the lower realms so that the rainbow bridge can be perceived, and this in turn leads to Asgard, the land where the sun shines directly. And actually, Steiner says, besides talking about the Norse gods as hierarchical beings, who have held back their own further promotion to still higher hierarchies. He also speaks of them in other contexts as those who were men in Atlantis and now become gods in the post-Atlantean age. So the world of Atlantis, which Steiner speaks about, not in great detail, but here and there, particularly in an early lecture cycle called Cosmic Memory, this is a world of mist, a world of great darkness at times, in which people could not see light, but clairvoyantly could see auras around everything. He also says that the Atlanteans, and this will be important for us as we go further in the stories, the Atlanteans had developed a technology based on control of etheric forces that went far beyond any technology that we have developed up to this point. He's speaking in 1919. Maybe it's a little outdated. But he goes further and says, we will never, in the post-Atlantean age, we will never attain the degree of technological sophistication that the Atlanteans had, because we are working with very crude physical means, and they were able to work directly into the world of the etheric. Said they mastered the forces of growth, which we find in the plant world. They mastered the forces of anti-gravity, which we also find in the plant world, that the plant is able to simply grow vertically, defying the gravity which would pull it back to the earth at all times. They master that which keeps the fluids flowing up and up in the plant. And therefore, they were able to develop flying machines. They were able to plant seeds that would grow overnight into tremendous structures. Think of Jack and the Beanstalk, but also think of the world Ash Yggdrasil. And that these etheric forces, or the lack of them, differentiated human beings into different types. So if you have a human being, an Atlantean human being, who is, as it were, filled with a proliferation of etheric forces, anti-gravitational, and always growing, what would you get? A giant. Not a surprise that there's a giant at the top of that beanstalk waiting for Jack. Not a surprise that the Norse myths begin with the giant Ymir, and that the race of giants, the Jotuns, play such an important role, forever battling with the Æsir, who represent a newer kind of force, the astral world, which is liberating itself from the mists and fogs, darkness, dullness, wetness of the strongly etheric Atlantean world. So this is very interesting how these worlds are laid out. And we could say that Asgard represents a step away from Atlantis, the beginning of the post-Atlantean times, and the gods who imbibed all of the wisdom and the power, because Atlantis was ruled by oracles who were in direct connection with the spiritual world. And we could say that the Æsir were those who left Atlantis before it fell into a state of spiritual deterioration and decadence. We might say that the Jotun, the giants in particular, were those who remained longer. And then only the dull etheric forces remain for them, nothing really redemptive. What about the gnomes or the dwarves, those who are so good with their hands? They are described as being metamorphosed from the maggots that fed on the dead body of Ymir. Not a very pretty picture at all. And they too sort of crawl within the cavities of the earth. They are individuals who are particularly connected to the physical world, pure and simple. So they are, on one level, less developed than the giants, who at least have physical and etheric forces, but because the gnomes are so connected to the physical mineral world, they have tremendous powers, a kind of Saturnine power, to work with physical laws and to develop the physical to a point where it is able to take on etheric capacity. So they are still very much connected with the technology of Atlantis. And we see that though the Aesir are extremely powerful, they are very dependent at times on the giants to do work with them. One of the first stories the children will hear is about this, the building of the wall of Asgard. And they are very dependent on the dwarves to forge their swords, to make their weapons, and to create something still of the old Atlantean technology to be utilized then by the Aesir. So this picture of the Norse myths, as Steiner says, is a very accurate rendition of the evolutionary stages that build up to the earth, going up to the creation of Ymir, and then from Lemuria, Atlantis, to the beginnings of the post-Atlantean times in which we live, really gives the children a tremendous recapitulatory story, not only of the earth as a whole, but of the creation of their own bodies, where they stand at this point, pulling away from being merely physical etheric force, physical etheric beings, and becoming instead physical, etheric, and astral in nature. And to see what a struggle this is and will continue to be, to some extent, for the rest of one's life. We'll go on.